Something has distracted you in the meantime. I bet you can sing back that opening Mozart phrase immediately. It isn't better than the Haydn, it's just catchier. Something else emerges in Mozart, though, beyond the sublime melodies that Haydn's music does not anticipate. Mozart, as well as being intrigued by the hidden curiosities and mystical secrets of Freemasonry, unashamedly celebrated in the Magic Flute, was fascinated by the supernatural and by what we would call psychological motive. In the decorously polite world that Mozart inhabited but never wholeheartedly embraced, aristocratic Vienna of the late 18th century, his operatic visions of heaven and hell, of the spiritual and the carnal, allow us to catch a glimpse of something very different and surprising. To be sure, people sensed he was an oddball at the time, disconcertingly gifted, outspoken, irreverent, in short, a strange mix of child and sage. Indeed, rather like Michael Jackson in our own time, Mozart's childhood had been forfeited to make way for a career as a freakishly talented boy prodigy to be touted around an adult world. Both artists retained in their grown-up writing a sense of the fragility and potential pitfalls of close relationships. One of Mozart's earliest friendships was with the young English prodigy Thomas Linley, whom he met and befriended in Italy. There's a famous painting of the two boys together in Florence in 1770, Mozart at the piano, Linley with the violin. Mozart was devastated when his childhood friend was killed in a boating accident just 8 years later, the same year as the death of Mozart's mother. Thus, when we glimpse life's darker side in Mozart's music or sense loneliness or insecurity, as in the desperately sad middle, slow movement of his 23rd Piano Concerto of 1786, it is as if a veil has momentarily slipped. Other composers, especially Beethoven and Berlioz, who followed in Mozart's wake, do little else than expose their internal turmoil all over the music, as though they're in a modern-day self-help group of composers with personality disorders. Mozart's emotional subtext, on the other hand, is disguised beneath the sheen of decorum and poise required of an 18th-century artisan. His dignified compassion in the face of life's challenges makes his music irresistible, even when it's tranquil. We have responded to this distant Austrian's voice across the years and the continents so spontaneously because his music seems simply to flow out of him intuitively without cynicism or intellectual pretension. Like the Gainsborough and Reynolds portraits painted during his lifetime, Mozart's music says, "I'll do my best to make this beautiful because that's what life at its best can be." The 1770s and 80s may have been dirty, unhealthy and dangerous for anyone but the most privileged, and life was grim and unfair, but it wouldn't have occurred to Mozart, nor Gainsborough or Reynolds for that matter, to reproduce that misery. They wanted to ennoble humanity. They succeeded. Much myth now surrounds Mozart, who was venerated in the 19th century as a kind of St. John the Baptist to Beethoven's Christ, and in the later 20th century as an innocent vessel transmitting God's message through music, sacrificing his health and ultimately his life in order to complete his final, incomprehensibly beautiful masterworks. Even in death, he holds a quasi-religious significance for his devotees. If you visit Vienna's St. Mark's Cemetery on the city's outskirts in an undistinguished part of town, you can, if you've nothing better to do in that culturally plentiful capital, wander solemnly up its leaf-strewn gravel paths until you find the non-grave of Amadeus Mozart. I say non-grave because his remains are not under the headstone that marks the spot. Indeed, the memorial plinth itself was constructed in more recent times to satisfy Mozart's grave tourists and is placed in what amounts to a random spot in the garden. Not only are the whereabouts of his bones not known, but, along with many others, his remains were dug up after his death, possibly crushed to reduce their bulk, and reinterred somewhere else, location also unknown. There's a theory that his skull was implausibly identified by a local grave digger in 1801, 10 years after Mozart's death, and that it eventually found its way to the vaults of the Mozart Foundation in Salzburg. But DNA tests have produced more or less the same divided outcome as with carbon dating of the Turin Shroud. Science says it's impossible. Believers continue to hope. But worrying about this great composer's remains is surely missing the point, as is the now 200-year-old mystery concerning Haydn's skull, long since separated from his body and the object of scrutiny and ghoulish bounty hunting worthy of Indiana Jones. Mozart left us far more poignant and permanent keepsakes of his existence than his bones. He left us his extraordinary music. What's more, unlike the paintings bequeathed to posterity by Constable or Rembrandt, his music has not ossified, frozen forever in time. Every time his music is performed, it lives again, fresh, newly awoken, sometimes interpreted surprisingly or unexpectedly, but always experienced in the here and now. This is music's most spectacular conjuring trick. Far from dying, it is in a perpetual state of rebirth. What mattered to Mozart was that his music should be enjoyed, not that he should be worshipped or revered, and it is this quality of treasured delight that captures his age. His music, whether in the unutterably lovely slow movement of his clarinet concerto, or the majestic optimism of his Jupiter symphony, or the coming to life of a dead man's statue in the concluding moments of Don Giovanni, or the heart-stopping delicacy of his later piano concertos, wants you, whoever and wherever you are, to feel good. That Beethoven changed the way society viewed composers should not cloud our judgment of his brilliant predecessor, who sought and gave one thing, pleasure. It's not known definitively whether Mozart and Beethoven ever met, despite their lives overlapping by 21 years, but two more different artists, creatively or temperamentally, it's hard to imagine. While Mozart's aim was to charm, seduce, and occasionally tease his audiences, Beethoven's mission was to confront them. With him, the composer as agent provocateur had arrived. Traditional histories like to equate Beethoven, the colossus of music in the early 1800s, with his contemporary Napoleon Bonaparte, revolutionary turned emperor and serial military adventurer. This convenient comparison is given extra poignancy by Beethoven's reference to the French despot in his momentous Third Symphony, these days known as the Eroica, but originally dubbed the Bonaparte. In fact, neither the well-worn anecdote about a disenchanted Beethoven scratching out the title page of his symphony bearing a dedication to Napoleon, nor the composer's musical radicalism are quite what they seem. Beethoven wasn't one composer, but three. He started off as a Mozart clone with a flair for playing the piano, became a tormented version of Haydn, and ended up isolated from the world by deafness, composing music that was to baffle, bewitch, and amaze every European musician of the next 100 years. Whatever you think of him, you cannot escape the fact that virtually everything that happened in 19th century music in some way began with Beethoven. All roads lead from him. He comes to us saddled with a fair amount of baggage. He was a moody, complicated man, possibly suffering from some degree of clinical depression, who found himself in possession of musical talents even he couldn't quite come to terms with. But revolutionary, the adjective often used of him, feels like the wrong word for a man who is fundamentally conservative, who rubs shoulders with the political and aristocratic elite of his day, and whose music, until quite near the end of his life, was well within the cultural mainstream of the early 19th century. As we see time and again, cutting-edge innovators like those of Beethoven's youth were composers whose names are now mostly forgotten. Johann Dussek, Louis Spohr, Muzio Clementi, Etienne Méhul, François-Joseph Gossec. Beethoven's genius was to convert their modernity into something that would, in due course, become the mainstream. Beethoven's eighth piano sonata, known as the Pathétique, was written when he was 28 and making a name for himself in Vienna. Compared to the music of his teacher Haydn or to Mozart, it seems much more dramatic and pianistic, almost to the point of theatricality, than anything they had written for the same instrument. In the context of 1790s Vienna, it sounds daring, emotionally charged and original. Beethoven, though, knew his contemporary music, and particularly the groundbreaking piano music of two London-based composers, Italian Muzio Clementi and Bohemian Johann Dussek. This pair were boldly pushing the virtuoso and expressive boundaries of the instrument, in consultation with the leading piano builder of the time, John Broadwood, another Londoner. Clementi's and Dussek's music was virtually unknown outside Britain, though. But Beethoven had found out about it and learnt from their innovations in style and playing technique. 7 years after composing his Pathetique Sonata, Beethoven stopped sounding like Mozart or Dussek or Haydn and started creating music beyond what they had imagined. The first major sign that he was breaking away from established formulas was his Eroica Symphony of 1804, which was a considerable challenge for audiences of the time, exciting and alarming his fellow Viennese in more or less equal measure. The Eroica deliberately sought to disrupt what an audience expected to hear in a symphony. Its first movement alone was roughly the length of a whole early Haydn symphony. For audiences reared on the regular, predictable patterns of Haydn and Mozart, the Eroica's many noisy surprises would have been both titillating and bewildering. Even its opening two chords seemed to be bellowing, "Wake up!" The story goes that Beethoven first composed the Eroica in honour of Napoleon, hero of the French revolutionary struggle, but that he scrubbed out Bonaparte's name in a rage and replaced it with the inscription, "Heroic Symphony, composed to celebrate the memory of a great man," on hearing that Napoleon had contradicted his earlier appeals to liberty, equality and fraternity by proclaiming himself emperor. His student and later biographer, Ferdinand Ries, claims to have heard Beethoven fume when hearing the news. Is he too, then, nothing more than an ordinary human being? Now he too will trample on the rights of man and indulge only his ambition. It may be that this oft-told anecdote underwent some layers of exaggeration as Beethoven's fame spread, not least because Beethoven dedicated a mass to Napoleon 6 years later, even after the emperor's troops had besieged and bombarded Vienna with Beethoven and a dying Haydn in it. Musicologists love to wax on about the ambitious first movement of the Eroica Symphony, mainly because it is unusually long and complex and provides fuel for seemingly endless analysis and scholarly scrutiny. Beethoven takes a relatively simple tune and builds from it a giant tapestry of ideas and musical meanderings. For me, though, it's not the Clever Clog's first movement that carries the killer punch, but the funeral march that follows it. What is different and new about this movement is not its structure, orchestration, or technical bravado, but its attitude. Whereas both Haydn and Mozart aimed to reveal human emotions through the filter of a gentlemanly, well-bred composure, the funeral march in Eroica is remarkable for the unflinching grip of its mood. It's not at all fanciful to link the mournful quality of the Marcia Funebre. Beethoven had borrowed the idea of a funeral march from French revolutionary music, the first of its kind in a symphony, with Beethoven's discovery during the months of composition that his deafness was becoming worse and would not be curable. There are many aspects of the movement that must have seemed strange to contemporary audiences. It seems to be restless, for one thing, as if looking for a resolution it never finds, moving briefly into a sunnier major key, then returning to its darker starting point, only to be churned around, experimented with, and fragmented. It plunges into a period of Bachian counterpoint, fashionable by that time only in sacred choral settings, where its old-fashioned earnestness seemed appropriate, followed by an impassioned, busy episode with flurrying strings and slower-moving woodwind. Finally, the processional march is recalled, this time disjointed, exhausted, and spent. The tune announced so confidently at the beginning now unexpectedly disintegrates. So for the perplexed audiences who first heard it in 1804 and 1805, even the funeral march is denied its thundering climax, collapsing rather than concluding. Grief is grief, pain is pain, and music, Beethoven seems to be proclaiming, is the art best placed to confront such darkness. Within the next two decades or so, most of his educated contemporaries gradually came to the same conclusion. For the first time since the death of Bach, the music of the moment seems to be attempting to portray more accurately the sadness and anxiety that people were actually experiencing. From the Eroica Symphony onwards, Beethoven self-consciously became a composer with a mission. He would change the world through his art. His music became serious-minded and earnest, but it's debatable whether he changed the world, not at any rate in the way his contemporaries William Wilberforce fought to end slavery, or Mary Wollstonecraft articulated the rights of women, or Edward Jenner developed the smallpox vaccine. But Beethoven certainly changed his art. This was Beethoven's great significance, not through form or musical language, but in recalibrating what music was for. Single-handedly, he turned it from genteel, ignorable after-dinner entertainment into an all-encompassing emotional experience, a way of perceiving life as a mighty struggle, the cry of the soul, the voice of conscience. He did not curry favour. Rather, he was seeking a relationship with destiny. His music yearned to be the expression of humanity's deepest desires and anxieties. Bach, Handel, Haydn and Mozart made music in the moment, for the moment. Beethoven challenged his listeners to return time and again to the unresolved conflicts that characterised his art. There would be no instant gratification, no easy triumph. Instead, there would be ambiguity, dynamic conflict and doubt. All the composers of the next 100 years were affected by this profound change of purpose. It's no exaggeration to say that after and because of Beethoven, music approached the status of a religion, complete with gods and goddesses for worshipping, a state of affairs that persists to this day. Had he been a level-headed craftsman like his friend Johann Hummel, composer and pianist, this transformation would not plausibly have caught the imagination of onlookers, but Beethoven's own personality oscillated between poignant vulnerability and raging anger. He gradually subsumed his own personality, his frustrations, burdens, and mostly unfulfilled desires, into his music, and the result was highly combustible. Beethoven couldn't hide his unstable emotions from the music, nor did he use the job of music-making as a distraction from the difficulties of life. Whatever else Beethoven's music may have been, it was certainly not intended to be escapist. The cult of the isolated, divine or demonic genius, of which Beethoven was the first outstanding musical example, did not happen in a vacuum, but rather as part of a general literary and artistic movement in the first 3 decades of the 19th century. It's a movement often labelled Romanticism, although, like the terms Renaissance, Baroque and Classical, it presents considerable difficulties when applied to music. In a nutshell, the problem with labelling anything romantic is that it has subsequently come to mean virtually anything, from the poetry of Lord Byron to the songs of Taylor Swift. Don't get me wrong, Swift's contemporary high school take on Romeo and Juliet, a love story, is a crackingly well-crafted pop song that I wish I'd written, but it has little in common with Pushkin's poem The Captain of the Caucasus or Schumann's Piano Concerto, both of which also carry the descriptor romantic. If romantic still means anything specific in the history of music, it best refers to a period when the composer's or performer's personal emotions or sentiment became paramount in the dialogue between music and audience. And Beethoven was the composer who began this transformation. Feeling is everything to Beethoven, as is the importance of his individual original voice, and a generation of composers reverentially followed in his wake, equally obsessed with the passionate confession, through music, of tender feelings, or, as Jane Austen reminds us, sense and sensibility. Beethoven and his contemporaries even made the natural world an extension of their feelings. A century earlier, God was the king of creation, and all nature reflected his power. Now, with the romantic attitude, nature was all about humankind. Musicians and poets saw the countryside as a roughly hewn wilderness, supplying countless images to convey the swirling emotional torrents of the yearning lover. Of course, none of them actually had to work the land. You observed peasants from the comfortable distance of your artistic nook, but you wouldn't want to be one. They were more like present-day privileged Western students trawling the developing world and writing blogs about how the world's poorest people enabled them to broaden their horizons. When Beethoven wrote his sixth, or pastoral, symphony in 1808, celebrating the delights of rural nature, his hometown of Vienna would still have been virtually unscathed by the industrial boom that was scarring the landscape and rupturing the communities of northern England. This was the same year in which William Blake evoked England's dark satanic mills in his poem Jerusalem. But Beethoven's easy-listening pastoral is not about the industrial rape of the countryside. It's not really about the countryside at all. Nature is there purely as a metaphor for feelings, as it was for Wordsworth and his daffodils, Shelley with his skylark, and Keats with his nightingale. As Beethoven's contemporary Wordsworth put it, "and led by nature into a wild scene of lofty hopes." No one followed Beethoven's lead in reflecting emotion through nature more passionately than his near-contemporary Franz Schubert, also based in Vienna. For Schubert, the birds, the bees, the woods and the trees came into their own above all in songwriting, at which he was simply unmatched before the 20th century. As well as 9 symphonies and much chamber music, he wrote over 600 songs before his death in 1828. Among them are 3 outstanding song cycles, Die Schöne Müllerin, The Pretty Miller Girl of 1824, Winterreise, Winter Journey of 1827, and Schwanengesang, Swan Song, collated and published posthumously. All 3 dwell on the pain of love, embodied poetically in the natural world. In Auf dem Flusse, On the Stream, from Winterreise, for example, a frozen brook represents the state of the distraught wanderer's heart, beating powerlessly beneath the hard, icy surface. He will carve the name of his now hopelessly lost beloved into the ice with a stone. It's hardly surprising that a composer like Schubert should be attracted to poetic texts that placed emotions in the relative safety of natural metaphor. Relationships between young men and women of his unpropertied class were fraught with restriction and inhibition. The tragedy is we have no way of judging a mature Schubert's thoughts on love because he didn't live long enough to have them. He died aged 31. Wilhelm Müller, the writer of many of his song lyrics, died aged 33. The study of the first half of the 19th century in art song is the study of young men with very little true understanding of women, who are typically portrayed as unattainable, goddess-like, simple, uneducated creatures, or just plain cruel. That is, not interested in the men. Indeed, it's hard to find a composer of the 19th century who didn't develop an infatuation or series of infatuations with his piano pupils, mostly single young women whose higher social status placed them, officially, out of bounds. A song like Abendstern, Evening Star, composed at the time Schubert was enduring a burning but impossible love for his 18-year-old piano pupil, Countess Carolina Esterhazy, whom he called a certain magnetic star, treats with great sensitivity the pain and loneliness of unfulfilled love. Not many songwriters in history can match the touching pathos of the song's plaint with such simple resources. I am the faithful star of love. I sow no seed, I see no shoot, and remain here, silent and mournful. In a sense, Schubert is the inventor of the 3-minute song with universal appeal, a form that is still thoroughly alive today, and one reason for this is his deliberate avoidance of the complex musical language he might have used in a symphony or string quartet. His songs were meant to sound like upmarket folk songs, immediately memorable, lyrically easily understandable, and relatively predictable in shape. The distance in form, intention, mood and expression between Schubert's songs for voice and piano and those of, say, Adele, is remarkably short, considering they are separated by 200 years. The only thing that would shock Schubert about Someone Like You is the fact that a young woman is the song's creator, not its object. The romantic spirit's darker manifestation, much in evidence in Beethoven's personality and creative output, was the idea that artists were in some way possessed of unnatural powers that it was their duty to give to the world, whatever the cost to their soul. For this aspect of their troubled genius, Beethoven and his contemporaries had 2 irresistible fictional role models, Faust and Prometheus. Though myths centred on both characters had existed for centuries, they were revived with enormous impact in two epic works by a writer whose imagination gripped composers for the whole of the 19th century, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. His Prometheus was published in 1789 and The Tragedy of Faust Part I in 1808, the year of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. Faust, as portrayed by Goethe, was an intellectual who sold his soul to the devil for worldly knowledge, power and pleasure. Both Goethe's play and Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus of 1604 seem to have drawn inspiration from an actual alchemist, Johann Georg Faust, who lived in early 16th century Germany. Prometheus was a Greek god who championed mankind, stealing fire for them from Zeus, being tortured for eternity as his punishment. Romantic-era poets, painters, and novelists were haunted by, but irresistibly drawn to, Prometheus, who was sometimes compared with Napoleon in poems and cartoons of the day, with spin-offs ranging from Blake's Prometheus Bound and Jean-Louis Césarlaire's The Torture of Prometheus to Percy Shelley's play Prometheus Unbound and Mary Shelley's hugely influential novel Frankenstein or The Modern Prometheus. Beethoven tackled both figures, composing Mephisto's Flea Song in tribute to Goethe's Faust and a ballet score, The Creatures of Prometheus, in 1801. His was the first of a flood of musical responses to the two legends in ensuing decades. Why were the figures of Faust and Prometheus so important to artists of the 19th century? Because they were both handy metaphors for the idea of the troubled, isolated genius whose gifts separated him from ordinary mortals, who represented the power that could be granted by divine or satanic intervention. Beethoven was music's first Faustian figure, a difficult, edgy, unpredictable maestro, a musical version of Lord Byron, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, or so his mesmerized audiences doubtless imagined. But many others were to follow. These included Hector Berlioz, Symphonie Fantastique of 1829 and The Damnation of Faust, 1846, Felix Mendelssohn, Die Erste Walpurgisnacht, 1832, Clara Wieck Schumann, Le Sabbat from Quatre Pièces Caractéristiques, 1835, Fanny Mendelssohn, Scenes from Faust the Tragedy, 1843, Robert Schumann, Scenes from Goethe's Faust, 1853, Franz Liszt, Faust Symphony, 1857, Charles Gounod, Faust, 1859, and Gustav Mahler, Eighth Symphony, 1906. Perhaps the most extreme example of the new wave of star performers who followed in Beethoven's wake was Italian violin virtuoso Niccolò Paganini. Paganini was rumoured to have struck a deal with the devil himself, Faust style, in order to acquire superhuman powers on his instrument and to put off the inevitability of death, a piece of fantastic spin fuelled by the fact that he refused the last rites on his deathbed and that his body was consequently not buried for another 36 years. In Aeschylus's 5th century BC telling of the Prometheus legend, Prometheus Bound, the rebellious Titan's gifts to man, as well as fire, include the tools for civilization, writing, mathematics, agriculture, medicine, and science. In the first decades of the 19th century, surrounded by the march of the Industrial Revolution, writers and artists grappled with a new scale of civilization, bigger cities, methods of communication, and inevitably, more powerful armies and weapons. Beethoven clearly found the warlike times in which he lived strangely inspiring, given the number of his pieces that refer to victorious struggles of one kind or another. Coriolan, 1807, Egmont, 1810, King Stephen, 1811, Wellington's Victory, 1813, or whose music has a martial theme, such as extended passages of several of his symphonies, especially the Eroica and the Fifth. As with industrial and scientific progress, so the symphony orchestra, which in the hands of Beethoven and Schubert increased in size and volume with every premiere. By the time he was halfway through his 9 symphonies, Beethoven had at his disposal double basses, which had supplanted the gentler bass violones to fortify the bottom end of his sound. And as well as a full complement of strings, anything from 12 to 30 violins, 4 to 12 violas, and the same number of cellos, his Fifth Symphony of 1808 added a very high-pitched piccolo, very low-pitched contrabassoon, and 3 trombones to the lineup for its noisy final movement. He surpassed himself at the premiere of his stirring Seventh Symphony in December 1813 with a violin section featuring 4 other distinguished Vienna-based composers of the time, Louis Spohr, Johann Hummel, Giacomo Meyerbeer and Antonio Salieri, the man quite wrongly accused in popular fiction of having conspired to murder, or at least silence, his rival, Mozart. The big hit of the evening was the second movement, the Allegretto, which has remained a public favourite ever since, notably providing the moving musical climax of the 2010 film The King's Speech. The symphony was being composed as Napoleon's Grande Armée was retreating from Moscow, and though Beethoven didn't mean it as such, the Allegretto's steady, funereal character has been associated ever since with that chilling cortege of 500,000 doomed Frenchmen. The scale of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony was to be overtaken in a dramatic way, however, by the ambition of his Ninth and Final Symphony. Indeed, the shadow of this mighty choral symphony was to loom majestically over the entire 19th century. Much has been made of the fact that the fourth and final movement adds a large chorus and 4 solo singers to the already sizable orchestral forces, the first time such a multitude had been glued on to the symphony. But large choruses, soloists and orchestra were bread and butter to Bach in his Passions, Handel in his oratorios, Mozart in his Requiem, and Haydn in his grand choral works. Beethoven, inspired by study of and admiration for Handel and Bach, merely had the idea of appending to a symphony something you might expect in an oratorio. The reason for the additional singers was not just to fill the hall with a magnificent noise, but to proclaim Beethoven's hopes for the future. In the face of political and social uncertainty, his answer to the anxieties of the hour was an appeal originally written by German Enlightenment poet Friedrich Schiller in 1785 that all people should unite in brotherly joy and revere the Creator, a brotherhood, incidentally, in which beggars and princes would be equals. He'd first expressed an interest in setting the poem to music when he was in his early 20s, before the full weight of the Napoleonic Wars began to envelop Europe. It may therefore be an unusual mixture of youthful dreams and mature exhortation, yet the ode to joy's arrival in the final movement of the Choral Symphony, revealed to the world in 2 subscription concerts in May 1824, one packed with friends and admirers, the other virtually empty, as the public struggled with Beethoven's modernity, is surely one of the most riveting and uplifting 18 minutes in all 19th century music. The most significant thing about Beethoven's Ninth, though, is not his introduction of a choral element into the symphony per se. It was his demonstration that the symphony as a form could and would thereafter mean anything it wanted, the bigger the better. This monumental new piece announced to the next generation of composers that the symphony was now to have an epic dimension. Never has an invitation to young composers been more enthusiastically embraced. For better or worse, the coming decades were to be about music taking on the task of reforming humanity, dreaming up a new utopia, and leading the arts to unite mankind. I'm not exaggerating. Composers of the second half of the 19th century really did believe that this was their role, and the messiah who rallied them to the cause was Beethoven. Even the modern world has found it hard to shake off this legacy. When the Berlin Wall was breached in 1989, a special performance there of the Ninth Symphony was broadcast around the world, with the word joy, Freude, replaced with the word freedom, Freiheit, lending those extraordinary events, its organisers doubtless believed, profundity, universality, meaning. The irony of what happened after Beethoven's Ninth, with composers from Berlioz to Wagner indulging in preposterously overblown claims for the importance of their work for the future of humankind, is that what Beethoven himself did next was the exact opposite. In the last 2 years of his life, now profoundly deaf and mostly bedridden by severe illness, Beethoven withdrew into a private sound world, composing six string quartets of astonishing, unapproachable intensity. They were modern not by the standards of 1826, but by the standards of a century later. These late quartets are almost embarrassingly private. It's as if he was working out some tortured mind game on the page or distracting himself from an unbearable sadness. Most of his contemporaries didn't know what to make of these late quartets. It was as if someone had time-travelled from 1930 and played 20th-century music to the mystified people of 1826. Could Beethoven hear the music of the distant future? If this was it, his vision was a bleak, uneasy one. The late quartets have a musical detachment about them, an intensity without warmth, and it seems as if the pleasure principle of the previous decades has been replaced with an urge to experiment with harmony at all costs. They are beautiful in an unsettling way. After Beethoven's death in 1827, a kind of parting of the waves took place between two versions of what a composer might do, whether to seek popularity with an audience or to become a martyr to your cause, suffering for your terribly important art. It's a tussle that continues to smoulder. The most popular composer in Beethoven's final years, even in Vienna where he lived, was not Beethoven himself, but the Italian Gioacchino Rossini, whose light-as-a-feather smash hit comic operas, such as The Barber of Seville of 1816, all laughs, saucy farce and hummable tunes, were arguably closer to the general public's idea of an ode to joy. The two composers did meet once, an encounter brokered by the kindly Antonio Salieri, and we have it word for word, since Beethoven, being deaf, had to have the conversation written down. The rules of engagement between the two types of composer were even evident in their short back and forth in 1822, with Beethoven congratulating Rossini on his success, but warning him not to write anything other than comic opera, as his character wouldn't suit it. It's a conversation that continues to be played out between self-styled serious composers and crossover composers to this day. Robert Schumann and his friend Felix Mendelssohn were German successors to Beethoven of a gentler mould. Like Schubert, they appealed to their audience not through comic opera, Rossini style, but by providing bittersweet, mostly tender reflections on love, art and life that were instantly enjoyable. Neither Mendelssohn nor Schumann planned to take over the world with his art, though both suffered for it nonetheless. Mendelssohn was the most conspicuously gifted young musician of the 19th century, producing a fabulous octet for strings aged 16 and an orchestral tribute to Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, aged 17, that dazzled all who heard it at the time. In fact, both pieces are still amongst the most performed of all 19th century favourites in a dauntingly strong field. In later years, Mendelssohn composed incidental music for a production of the play itself, with additional scenes and characters, including a wedding march, the wedding march, that has since been used at what must now be millions of weddings. But Mendelssohn had to struggle against both snobbery and bigotry. The very fact that his music was so instantly popular with audiences, particularly among prosperous middle-class Britons, and indeed Queen Victoria, with whom he became friends, was enough for there to be a backlash against him. His critics, often motivated by anti-Semitism, branded him old-fashioned or lacking in originality, originality being the most overhyped quality in the history of music. Wagner's comments in his toxic The Jews in Music, 1850, were fairly typical, if more long-winded than most. Whereas Beethoven, the last in the chain of our true music heroes, strove with highest longing and wonder-working faculty for the clearest, certainest expression of an unsayable content through a sharp-cut, plastic shaping of his tone pictures, Mendelssohn, on the contrary, reduces these achievements to vague, fantastic shadow forms, midst whose indefinite shimmer our freakish fancy is indeed aroused, but our inner, purely human yearning for distinct artistic sight is hardly touched with even the merest hope of a fulfilment. The washiness and whimsicality of our present musical style has been, if not exactly brought about, yet pushed to its utmost pitch by Mendelssohn's endeavour to speak out a vague and almost nugatory content as interestingly and spiritedly as possible. In 1889, the enormous popularity in Britain of Mendelssohn's oratorio Elijah caused George Bernard Shaw to lampoon its Sunday school sentimentalities and its music school ornamentalities. The composer who stands at the antithesis of Mendelssohn, who took Beethoven's call to arms most to heart, adopting early on the possessed maestro option, all cutting-edge and misunderstood angst, was the French firebrand Hector Berlioz. Despite being French, Berlioz may as well have been German, so keen was he to assume the Beethoven throne. He too was drawn to the same literary icons like a moth to a flame, Sir Walter Scott, Lord Byron, Goethe and Shakespeare. His personal identification with romantic heroes such as Romeo in Romeo and Juliet seemed to have fueled not just musical inspiration, but his crazed, desperate infatuation with a Shakespearean actress, Harriet Smithson. Mind you, without his 12-year obsession with her, the world wouldn't have had Berlioz's hugely influential Symphonie Fantastique, Episode de la Vie d'un Artiste in 1830, the oratorio Romeo et Juliette, the operas Les Troyennes and Béatrice et Bénédicte, and his musical treatments of King Lear and Hamlet. In December 1832, he premiered in Paris a sequel to the Symphonie Fantastique called Lelio, Le Retour à la Vie, Return to Life, part of which was a fantasia on The Tempest. At this performance, he finally met Harriet, who was somewhat taken aback at how much she seemed to feature in Berlioz's works, and their tempestuous, unrealistic, and ultimately destructive relationship erupted into life, despite the fact that neither spoke the other's language. A comparison of Berlioz's Grande Messe des Morts, Requiem of 1837, with Beethoven's choral symphony of just 13 years earlier, provides a stark illustration of how far the ambition of large-scale music had already ballooned. It calls for a minimum of 200 singers, a string section alone of 108 players, 20 woodwind players, including 2 cor anglais and 8 bassoons, 12 French horns, 8 cornets, 12 trumpets, 16 trombones, 6 tubas, 4 ophiclides, a cross between a bass tuba and a prototype saxophone that had only been patented 16 years earlier, 10 timpani players on 16 drums, 4 gongs, 2 bass drums, and 10 pairs of cymbals. Even the most generously funded rendition of Beethoven's Ninth would require a meagre third of those forces. While at the heart of Beethoven's symphony lies a vision of a better civilization led by a benign deity, Berlioz, a lifelong atheist, attempts to evoke the apocalypse and final judgment in sound. In the intervening years, music had grown from joyful servant of humankind and the Almighty to a bigger experience than both of them. Liszt and Wagner idolized Berlioz, which would explain much that happened in the second half of the 19th century, a torrid drama that will unfold in the next chapter. Berlioz never flinched from reminding whoever would listen of his great troubles and adversities, nor from absorbing those torments in his music, much of which is richly rewarding to listen to. His relationships were stormy and plagued with bad luck. The death of his son in 1867 more or less killed him. Yet he survived to the relatively impressive age, for the time, of 66, and made a good living as a conductor, music critic and chief librarian of the Paris Conservatoire. Compared to the nightmare existence that Robert Schumann endured, it was a walk in the park, though surprisingly, Schumann's is the music of greater tranquility and warmth. Schumann was, however, one of a group of composers who between them made the piano the essential 19th century instrument. The tender serenity found in much of his piano music he and his clique had learnt not so much from Beethoven and his theatricality, but from the example of a lesser-known Irish composer, John Field, who made his name first in London, then in Catherine the Great's imperial capital of St. Petersburg. Field is one of those composers who's been dealt an inexplicably poor hand by posterity, but who had a huge influence on other composers in their own time. It is to Field we owe the piano nocturne, a form taken up enthusiastically by Chopin and later many others, and his flowing, rapturous piano style became a rough template for what a composer in the 19th century was expected to do with the instrument. Describing Field's piano music 50 years later, the Hungarian composer virtuoso Franz Liszt poetically summed up how the Irishman captured the spirit of the early century romantic movement in music. These half-formed sighs floating through the air, softly lamenting and dissolved in delicious melancholy. Quite apart from all that delicious melancholy, there was something else going on, or not going on, in Field's nocturnes that was to reverberate throughout the coming century, and that was a major break with the Haydn-Mozart era. Field's nocturnes are not journeys, they're mood pictures. He abandoned the structural architecture of the previous half-century, sonata form, and let his passion at the keyboard have a rhapsodic, free rein. This possibility, simply evoking an unidentified atmosphere in sound, was to lodge in the minds of many composers in the coming decades and bear rich fruit. Field's first set of nocturnes were published in his adopted home of Russia in 1812, while Napoleon's colonial ambitions there were being buried under a mountain of snow, fire, starvation and disease. 2 years earlier, he had married his former piano pupil, Adelaide Percheron, and together they shared the stage as touring pianists. While it may sound a vaguely familiar story, one we will encounter shortly with the similarly passionate and professional partnership of pianist-composers Robert and Clara Wieck Schumann, it is important to note how exceptional the concept was, before the 20th century, of a woman being able to pursue any professional career in music. These significant exceptions were possible thanks to the piano. The early 19th century was the beginning of a new era of amateur musicianship, a mass movement of skilled and semi-skilled musical participation that was unprecedented in history and which centred on the piano. Before gramophones and radios, the piano was the only source of music in many a middle-class home, and the sharing of homemade music was a habit that lasted for many families until the Second World War. The middle classes proudly installed factory-made pianos in their drawing rooms and needed music to play on them. Composers from Field and Beethoven onwards were happy to oblige in vast quantities. What's more, here was a chance for women to become involved in composing and performing, pursuits from which they had largely been excluded up until now. The fact that piano music could be written in the privacy of the home and sent off to a sheet music publisher allowed women who were routinely taught piano skills from an early age to compose and, in due course, to perform in public, despite virulent parental disapproval in all but a handful of cases. Felix Mendelssohn's older sister Fanny grew up as musical as her brother, their music tutor Carl Zeller writing to Goethe in 1816 about their father Abraham Mendelssohn. He has adorable children and his oldest daughter could give you something of Sebastian Bach. This child is really something special. As her talents developed, so did family resistance to her taking up music as a career. Felix published some of her songs under his name, and her husband, artist Wilhelm Hensel, was broadly supportive of her composing and of her occasional performances at the piano. Her compositions are delightful. They include exquisite songs in the Schubert tradition, like Die Ersehnte, the yearned-for one, and a characterful portrait of the months of the year for solo piano, Das Jahr, which compares well with her brother's enormously popular collection of Songs Without Words. And her death, aged just 42, deprived music of a talent formidable enough to have challenged many myths surrounding musical women in the Victorian era. The reality was, though, that while it might be possible, with good reading and writing, to become the author of a novel, as Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters, or George Eliot proved, it was practically impossible to write large-scale forms, such as a symphony or an opera, without years of instruction and specialist knowledge. This was the barrier. Training that most prevented women composers coming to the fore in the 19th century. In 1838, 28-year-old Robert Schumann composed an 8-part homage to Johannes Kreisler, the fictional musician who featured in the comic novels of E.T.A. Hoffmann, Beethoven enthusiast and author of The Nutcracker, Coppelia, and The Tales of Hoffmann. Although Schumann dedicated the Kreisleriana to his friend Frédéric Chopin, What it was really was a musical love letter to Clara Wieck, the young woman Schumann would soon marry, despite legal proceedings instigated by her father. As well as nurturing and inspiring her husband, even as mental illness drove him to attempted suicide and an early death, Clara Wieck was a composer of distinction, from her astonishingly adept and undeservedly neglected piano concerto, written when she was just 17, to her passionate set of 6 songs for Denmark's Queen Carolina Amalia, culminating in the enchanting Die Stille Lotusblume, with its unexpectedly bluesy opening chords. She became one of the most famous concert pianists of the century. In a 60-year career on the concert stage, she tirelessly championed the music of her husband, of Brahms, and of Chopin. One day, I hope, her immense contribution to Western music and the courage of her determination to pursue music at the highest level against all odds will be properly recognised. The composer who probably owes her the greatest debt of gratitude, Frédéric Chopin, she first met in Paris when, aged 12, she played to him one of his own exquisite nocturnes, Opus 9, Number 2. Of the generation that followed Beethoven, Chopin was the composer whose influence was slowest to make its impact. The reason for this is that, like Beethoven's late quartets, Chopin's music is unusually intimate. He preferred not to perform in large concert halls, as was increasingly the vogue, but rather in small salons and private homes. Consequently, his fame spread person by person, fan by fan. He was arguably more like a novelist than a composer in this respect, people falling for his music as they would a newly discovered secret passion. Listening to Chopin after the helter-skelter psychological drama of Beethoven or the theatrical bravado of Berlioz, it's as if someone has opened a window and let in some fresh, balmy evening air. Though he settled in France, the quality that most pervades Chopin's style is homesickness for his native Poland. Unlike expat composers Rossini, Cherubini, Meyerbeer and others drawn to Paris in the 19th century, seeking career upgrades and access to a lucrative Parisian penchant for opera, Chopin arrived there as a refugee from political repression at home. Sometimes he expressed his longing for Poland, at that time swallowed up in the Russian Empire, through his highly stylized adaptation of Polish folk dances, mazurkas and polonaises. Though they were intended to evoke such rustic dances, they were meant to be played and listened to, not as accompaniment for actual dancing. Chopin stands at the critical pivot in 19th century music. In his over 60 heartfelt mazurkas, love letters to a homeland he would never see again, he anticipated composers in every European country in the second half of the century, especially those in nations struggling to shrug off an imperial yoke, finding inspiration in the folk music of their own communities. In his 21 nocturnes and 27 etudes, Chopin managed to set a staggering standard of technical virtuosity for players at the same time as creating something beautiful for listeners to enjoy, and he initiated a golden age of the piano. His example was still proving influential for the likes of Debussy, Ravel, and the jazz legend Bill Evans in the 20th century. Chopin's rich and ambiguous harmonies, interwoven intricately between the hands, looked to the future, leaving behind the primary colour certainties of Gluck, Mozart, Haydn and early Beethoven once and for all. After a period of simplicity, Chopin was nudging music's pendulum back towards complexity once more. There is a delicacy and gentleness to Chopin's music, though, that represents the final curtain call of the age of elegance and gracefulness, of sense and sensibility. His heroes, notwithstanding the underrated John Field, were Mozart and Bach, composers in whose music dignity was everything. Ill health plagued Chopin throughout his life, and in his final 3 years he became so weak he needed round-the-clock care. TB finally killed him in 1849. His last public concert was given at London's Guildhall in November 1848, a fundraising event for Polish refugees. He may have been unable to return home to Poland to die, but his heart had never left it. The year of Chopin's final concert, 1848, was one of huge political upheaval across Europe. It was a year of revolutions. One of the rebels clamouring for social change in an uprising in Dresden was a young Richard Wagner. Trouble was brewing, and a period that began with fear of apocalypse was replaced with one in which the apocalypse might be played out within music itself, by that same firebrand on a Dresden street. Chapter 5, The Age of Tragedy, 1850 to 1890. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show, says David Copperfield in the opening line of the eponymous novel by Charles Dickens, published in 1850. It's a book about the twists and turns of destiny, and, it being an English novel rather than a German, Italian, French or Russian one, despite tragedy along the way, all ends satisfactorily, with a fresh start in the new world, the reward for stalwart and honest perseverance. The second half of the 19th century was, for music, all about destiny too, though since music was dominated by Germans, Italians, Frenchmen and Russians, tragedy triumphed, and it all ended in death. Indeed, continental European composers of the second half of the 19th century were completely obsessed with death and destiny. It's hard to find a piece of music written between 1850 and 1900 that isn't about one or the other. Composers were never happier than when they were able to combine them both, preferably bolted on to a doomed love affair in an opera. But what these Victorian-age composers didn't realise was that destiny was about to give them a tremendous jolt. As the 6 million visitors to London's Great Exhibition of 1851 were prophetically promised, the future was about two things, technology and the world beyond Europe. If you were looking for a starting point for the death and destiny craze in music, you could do a lot worse than Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, Episode de la vie d'un artiste en cinq parties, first performed in Paris in 1830. Although it's called a symphony, Berlioz's intention with the five-episode orchestral fantasy was to tell a story, without words, a story that begins with a dream, which, unsurprisingly, turns into a nightmare, this being the 19th century. His written introduction to it explains. The author imagines that a young musician, afflicted by the moral sickness which a well-known writer, François-René de Chateaubriand, has called the wave of passions, la vague des passions, sees his perfect, idealized woman and falls desperately in love with her. Curiously, the image of his beloved only ever comes into his mind associated with a musical theme, which, passionately, reminds him of her nobility and shyness. Both the melodic image and its model pursue him incessantly like a double idée fixe. That is the reason for the constant appearance in every movement of the symphony of the melody that begins the first. The transitions from this state of dreamy melancholy, interrupted by fits of inexplicable joy, to delirious passion, with its outbursts of fury and jealousy, its returns of tenderness, its tears, its religious consolations, all this forms the subject of the first movement. I feel emotionally wrung out already. It's worth pointing out, since we met her earlier, that the woman Berlioz himself was dreaming about when he wrote this was the object of his obsession, the Irish actress Harriet Smithson, but also that the big tune, his so-called idée fixe, he'd already composed a year previously as part of a cantata he'd entered into a competition. In the cantata, the tune represented a tragic Muslim princess, Erminia, during the Crusades. Not for the first or last time, a composer recycled a good tune that had not yet found its audience. The Symphonie Fantastique's musical narrative moves on to a ball, or, as Berlioz describes it, a festive orgy, a gentler scene in the countryside involving shepherds that is reminiscent of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, then two movements that descend into Hammer horror-style darkness. The first is a march to the scaffold, in which our hero poisons himself with opium, falls into a fevered comatose state, sees himself murder the object of his infatuation, is duly apprehended, and becomes onlooker to his own execution by guillotine, with a semi-comic musical effect depicting his head being chopped off. The innocent, late beloved has further torment in store in the afterlife, since the finale is a nightmare witch's Sabbath, ostensibly convened to mark the presumably headless artist's funeral ceremony, though really its purpose is to escort the hapless girl to hell in a Bruegelesque frenzy, a grotesque, diabolical grind show. It would appear that this latter vision of semi-erotic infernal punishment was Berlioz's revenge on Harriet Smithson, who wouldn't answer his letters of lovesick longing nor agree to meet him, and was rumoured to be having an affair with her manager, though it could easily have been one of her other celebrity admirers, an impressive list that included Victor Hugo, Eugène Delacroix, Théophile Gautier and Alexandre Dumas. Heaven knows what the poor woman thought when she eventually heard the Berlioz piece at a Paris concert and read the programme notes, although it didn't prevent her from marrying him 3 years later. The fusion of doomed love, nightmarish pandemonium, and illustrative orchestral narrative that characterises the Symphonie Fantastique lit a fuse in the imaginations of many other composers of the period, as we shall see. But it was inevitable that Berlioz, now smitten beyond sanity with Ms. Smithson, would turn to arguably the greatest of all doomed love romantic tragedies, that of Romeo and Juliet. Indeed, it was seeing her in Shakespeare's play at the Paris Odeon that detonated the infatuation in the first place. Berlioz's Romeo et Juliet of 1839 was a large-scale dramatic choral symphony, Beethoven's Ninth, with a story and cast of characters. Berlioz was not alone in his obsession with this tragic love story. Romeo and Juliet's agonising predicament acts like wallpaper to 19th century music. Almost wherever you look, it is lurking in the background, provoking decade-by-decade settings of many shapes, sizes and formats. The powerful chemistry of teenage innocence and sexual awakening, desperate longing against the odds, warring families, inevitable calamity, suicide and, finally, union in death, more or less summed up the ingredients of the perfect 19th century plot. Berlioz himself was encouraged in his endeavours after reviewing a performance in Florence of Vincenzo Bellini's opera I Capuleti e I Montecchi in 1834, one of several operatic treatments of the story that century, the most conspicuously successful being Charles-François Gounod's Romeo et Juliet of 1867, which had three momentous openings that year in Paris, New York and London. The latter production at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden caused a sensation that rocked Victorian London when its two leads, Adelina Patti and Ernesto Nicolini, both married to other people, did in fact fall in love, kissing on the lips 29 times during the balcony scene. They later settled down together at her splendid neo-Gothic castle in Wales, Craigar Nos, where she built her own opera house, and which is rumoured to be haunted by the spirits of Patti, Nicolini,